Whispers from the Dark, Season 2, Episode 1 with Raven Vale. When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Hauska Castle. The gate that was never meant to be closed. There are places in this world that were never meant to be built upon. Not because the ground was unstable, not because folklore warned against it, but because something beneath the surface was already there, already waiting. Long before the castle walls rose, long before stone was stacked on stone, long before men carved crosses into door frames and prayed, desperately prayed, that they would be enough. There is a hole beneath Hauska Castle, a vertical shaft plunging into the earth, too deep to measure with any tool medieval engineers possessed, too wide to be natural, too perfectly circular to be accidental, too deliberate to ignore. When prisoners were lowered into it during the Middle Ages, they came back screaming. Not all of them. Some never came back at all. The rope would return empty, knots untied from the inside. Men simply gone, swallowed by whatever waited below. But the ones who did return, the ones who survived long enough to be pulled back into daylight, they came back changed, fundamentally altered, no longer entirely themselves. Those who survived did not age from time spent below. They aged from what they witnessed. Hair turned white in minutes, not gradually. In the span of heartbeats, color drained from every strand. Faces collapsed into hollow masks. Skin sagged as if decades had passed in moments. Eyes refused to focus on the living world anymore. They stared through people, past them, into something else. Entirely. They spoke of winged shapes moving in the darkness below, of sounds that didn't belong to animals, something alive in that darkness, something that had been alive down there far longer than any human civilization. And then, after speaking these things, they begged to be executed. Not because they were wounded, not because they were in pain. Not because their bodies had been damaged in any visible way, but because whatever they had seen down there, whatever had touched their minds in that absolute darkness, whatever had reached through the black and brushed against their consciousness, was still with them, still inside them, still whispering things no human should hear, still scraping at the inside of their skulls like fingernails on bone. Hauska Castle was not built to protect a kingdom. It was not built to guard a border. It was built to seal something away. Tonight, we're going to talk about what that something might be. And more importantly, we're going to ask whether it's still down there. This is Whispers from the Dark. Season 2. I'm Raven Vale. Hauska Castle stands deep in the forests of what is now the Czech Republic. The trees around it grow dense and silent. Not the peaceful silence of wilderness, the oppressive silence of a held breath, the kind of silence that makes you aware of your own heartbeat. Even today, hikers report feeling watched when they pass through the area. Not vague unease. Something specific, something focused, the primitive certainty that something is paying attention to you. Animals refuse to den nearby. Hunters have noted for generations that deer avoid the clearing entirely. Wolves pass through without stopping. Birds avoid the canopy, not because there's no food. For reasons they cannot articulate, but their instincts understand perfectly. The castle was constructed in the late 13th century under King Ottokar II of Bohemia. On paper, it should have been a military stronghold. But nothing about Hauska Castle makes strategic sense. No access to water. No well was ever dug within its walls. Any siege would end in surrender within days from thirst alone. No trade routes pass within miles. There was nothing to tax, nothing to monitor, nothing to control. No strategic position. The castle sits in a low area, surrounded by hills. Any army could bombard it from higher ground. No farmland for supply. Nothing to sustain a garrison long term. And then there are the walls themselves. They face inward. Think about that for a moment. Every castle wall in human history is designed to repel attackers from outside. Walls face outward. Defenses aim at approaches, not at Hauska. Arrow slits open into empty courtyards instead of outward toward potential enemies. Murder holes are positioned above interior doorways, not exterior gates. Defensive positions aim at the castle's own rooms, its own corridors. Engineers who study medieval fortifications call it impossible. Historians call it inexplicable. Architects say it violates every principle of fortification, because Hauska Castle was never meant to keep invaders out. It was meant to keep something in. A massive stone lid. A consecrated seal. A physical. Barrier placed over an opening that could not stay closed on its own. Generations before construction began, locales avoided the site completely. They had names for it. Old names in languages that predate Czech. Names that translate to the breathing place or the gateway. They spoke of a bottomless pit that exhaled at night. Not wind. Breath. The slow, rhythmic exhalation of something vast and patient far below. Sounds rose from the opening after dark. Screams that echoed from impossible depths. Wings beating against stone, but wings too large, too leathery, making sounds no bird could make. A low rumble like distant thunder that never stopped. A sound that vibrated in your chest if you stood too close. A sound that made your teeth ache. Horses bolted when brought near the clearing. Not spooked, terrified. Eyes rolling white, foam at their mouths, willing to break their own legs to escape. Dogs dragged their owners away, hackles raised, whining in frequencies that suggested pain. Birds would not nest in surrounding trees. Even insects seemed fewer near the opening. Villagers believed the pit was a gateway to hell. Not metaphorically, literally. A physical opening into the realm of eternal punishment. A tear between the world of the living and the world of the damned. Medieval theology took hell seriously as a geographic location. Not a metaphor. A place that existed somewhere beneath the earth's surface. And they believed certain places on the surface world connected to it. Thin places. Tears in the fabric of reality, where the boundary between here and there had worn through. When the king's investigators arrived, they found the hole exactly as described. Vertical. Perfectly circular. Too perfect to be natural erosion. Vast. Wide enough that three men standing shoulder to shoulder could have been lowered together. Unmeasurable. They brought hundreds of feet of rope, the finest hemp rope available. They lowered weighted ropes. The rope ran out. All of it. Still no bottom. They dropped torches. Bundles of pitch-soaked wood burning brightly. The flames disappeared into the dark without sound. No impact. No echo. Just gone. They shouted into the void. Priests chanted prayers. Only echoes returned. But under the echoes, something else. A sound that might have been laughter, or might have been something breathing. Medieval authorities made a decision. If rope could not measure the depth, if fire could not illuminate the bottom, they would send down the one thing they considered more expendable. They would use condemned prisoners to explore what lay below. The first volunteer was a murderer awaiting execution, a man scheduled to hang at dawn, a man with nothing left to lose, or so he thought. He was offered a bargain, Survive the descent. Describe what you see, and you will be spared execution. The man laughed. Whatever was down there, he reasoned, couldn't be worse than the rope. He was wrong. They lowered him slowly, rope creaking under his weight, lantern shaking in his grip. His voice echoed up the shaft as he descended. At first, he reported nothing unusual. Stone walls, temperature dropping, air growing damp, everything you'd expect from a deep cave. 50 feet, 100 feet, 150, still nothing unusual. 200 feet. His voice changed. The tone shifted from confident to uncertain. What is this? He called up. What is this on the walls? They asked him to describe it. He couldn't, or wouldn't. His voice became quieter, more hesitant. 250 feet. There's something moving down here. They asked him to describe it. Silence for a moment. Then, I can't. I don't have words for it. 300 feet. His voice became frantic. Words tumbled over each other, breathing ragged. Pull me up. Pull me up now. Oh God, pull me up. It's... And then he started screaming. Not words. Not sentences. Just raw animal terror. The sound a human throat makes when the mind behind it has shattered. Three men hauled on the rope. Strong men, used to physical labor. They pulled as fast as they could. He fought them the entire way up, not fighting to stay down. Fighting as if something was pulling him back. The rope would go slack suddenly, then snap taut. Slack again. Taut. Like something was playing tug of war with his life. When his head finally emerged into daylight, the gathered crowd gasped. The man who emerged was not the man who went down. Every strand of hair had turned white. Not grey. White. The color of bone. His skin sagged like a corpse's, like something had pulled all the moisture out of him. Like he'd aged 50 years in the span of minutes. His eyes stared through people instead of at them. Pupils blown wide, unblinking. Fixed on something no one else could see. They cut the rope and pulled him onto solid ground. He lay there, curled into himself, trembling. He could barely form words. His jaw trembled. His teeth chattered despite the warm afternoon. His hands clutched at the grass like he needed to confirm it was real. But when he did manage words, when he finally spoke, he begged them to kill him. Please, he whispered. Please, God, kill me now. The captain asked what he'd seen. It's still here, the man said. It's still with me. It's inside my head now. I can hear it. I can feel it. It's scraping. It won't stop scraping. They asked him to describe what he'd seen below. He laughed, a broken sound. Wings, he said. But not wings. Limbs, but not limbs. Shapes that hurt to look at. Sounds that tasted like metal. And it knew I was there. It knew. It watched me. It's still watching. 3 days later, his heart stopped. The official record says natural causes. But witnesses, the guards who watched him in his cell during those final 3 days, reported something else. They said he died with his eyes open, staring at the ceiling. They said his lips moved constantly, soundlessly, as if responding to something no one else could hear. They said that in the moments before his heart stopped, he smiled. And the smile was wrong. It wasn't his smile. Others followed. 7 more prisoners in total. Some never came back up. The rope would go slack. When pulled, it would return empty. The knots untied from the inside. Not cut. Not frayed. Untied. As if the prisoner had released himself willingly and stepped off into the dark. Those who did return were catatonic or babbling, clawing at their own faces, drawing blood, describing things that made no biological sense, winged humanoids crawling along stone walls like insects, sounds that caused physical agony, a presence that felt like drowning. After the seventh attempt, the experiment stopped. Not because they had answers. They had no answers. But because the interrogators were terrified. Because the priests refused to continue. Because they understood that whatever was down there should not be disturbed further. If the pit was so dangerous, why not collapse it? Why not solve the problem the obvious way? They tried. Cartloads of rock were brought from quarries, wagon load after wagon load dumped into the opening, enough to fill any normal cave system. The material disappeared without trace. The pit remained, the depth unchanged, as if the rock was falling forever or being consumed by something below. And then the ground began to shift. Overnight, between one sunset and the next sunrise, the earth around the pit would move. In the morning, the opening would be the same size as before. The hole reopened itself, resisted burial, refused closure. So they changed tactics. Instead of burying the gateway, they would entomb it. Hauska Castle rose directly over the pit, stone by stone. The chapel was built first. Not the walls, not the towers. The chapel, the most holy space. Built before anything else, its altar positioned precisely above the hole. Every stone was blessed during placement. Priests performed rituals over each block before it was set. Holy water was mixed into the mortar. Prayers were carved into surfaces that would never be seen. The construction site became a continuous religious ceremony. Prayers chanted 24 hours a day. The walls were covered in religious imagery. More than was typical even for a medieval chapel. Crosses, dozens of crosses, hundreds of crosses. Saints, every protector saint known to medieval Christianity. Michael the Archangel, George the Dragon Slayer. Every saint associated with protection from evil. Protective symbols from multiple traditions, not just Christian. Pre-Christian warding marks. The builders didn't care about theological purity. They cared about effectiveness. They wanted every layer of protection available. This wasn't decoration. This was spiritual engineering, the medieval equivalent of building a containment facility for hazardous material. This was humanity using every tool at its disposal to seal something away. Medieval people understood hell as a physical realm beneath the surface. They believed boundaries between worlds could thin, could tear, could develop openings that allowed movement between. Hauska Castle was built on one of those tears, or rather, built over one, built to keep it from widening. For 7 centuries it has held. Inside the chapel are frescoes that don't match any known Christian iconography of the period. Art historians have studied them for decades. They've compared them to every known example of medieval religious art in Europe, and they cannot explain these paintings. One fresco shows a half-human creature with too many limbs, not the standard depiction of demons. This thing has human features, a human torso, but limbs that multiply, that branch, that don't make anatomical sense. Limbs that hurt to look at, because your brain cannot process the geometry. Another depicts an archer firing at something emerging from the ground. But the thing is wrong. Its proportions violate basic rules of perspective. It seems to exist in multiple layers simultaneously, and the archer's face shows genuine terror. His mouth is open mid-scream, his eyes are too wide, his body position suggests he's about to flee. A third shows figures fleeing from winged shapes descending from above or ascending from below. The perspective is deliberately ambiguous, but the terror on the faces is not. The proportions are wrong. The expressions aren't symbolic. They're visceral, real, raw, mouths open, mid-scream, eyes wide with genuine horror, bodies twisted in positions that suggest panic. Art historians can't place these images within any known tradition. They don't match biblical narratives. They don't align with regional folklore. They don't fit any known pattern of medieval artistic expression. They don't look like religious allegory. They look like documentation, like someone painted what they saw, like an eyewitness sketch, like a warning left in paint for anyone who came after, painted directly above the sealed pit, where anyone entering the most sacred space would see them, would be reminded, would know. None of the artists signed their work, as if they didn't want to be associated with what they'd depicted, as if they feared marking themselves as witnesses to something forbidden. Despite its massive construction, despite the expense and effort of building it, almost no one stayed at Hauska Castle for long. Soldiers refused assignments there. Knights ordered to garrison the castle found reasons to leave, developed sudden illnesses, requested transfers, in some cases simply deserted. Caretakers quit within weeks, sometimes days. When questioned, they couldn't always articulate why. Just a feeling. Just a sense that they weren't alone. Nobles avoided it completely. It should have been a prestige posting. But nobles made excuses, claimed other obligations, anything to avoid taking residence at Hauska. Those who did stay reported consistent phenomena, footsteps in empty corridors. Not the creaking of old wood. Actual footsteps, the sound of boots on stone, voices from sealed rooms, conversations heard through thick walls, the sounds of human activity coming from spaces that were locked, that no one had entered for months, the sensation of being watched by something just outside peripheral vision. When you turn, there's nothing. But the moment you look away, the sensation returns. Dreams so vivid they felt like memories. Not nightmares. Worse. Dreams where you're somewhere else. Someone else. Dreams where you're down in the pit, in the dark, and something is speaking to you in a language that hurts to hear, but you understand perfectly. The forest reclaimed the surrounding land. But stories persisted. Lights in windows of an abandoned structure. Travelers passing at night reported seeing candles burning in windows of towers that had no floors, nothing but empty space behind the glass. Figures moving behind glass. Shadows pacing back and forth. Human shapes, or almost human. Visible for just a moment before disappearing. Locals refused to hunt near the castle, even during harsh winters when game was scarce elsewhere. The deer population around Hauska remained unnaturally dense because hunters wouldn't pursue them there. Time behaved strangely there, they said. People would enter the forest intending to walk the perimeter. 20 minutes at most. They'd emerge hours later, the sun in a completely different position, unable to account for the lost time. Hauska became a place spoken about only in whispers, a place parents warned children away from without explaining why, a place you didn't look at too long. In 1939, the castle found new occupants who did not believe in curses or medieval fear, who believed in science, in progress, in the supremacy of the rational mind, and the power of the human will to understand and control everything. SS officers seized Hauska Castle. Not Wehrmacht, not regular army. SS, the elite, the true believers. Specifically, members of the Ahnenerbe, the Nazi organization devoted to researching occult power, ancient mysteries, anything that might give the Third Reich an edge in the coming war. Not for military purposes. The castle had no strategic value whatsoever. No defensive position, no tactical advantage. For occult research, for investigation into what they called paranatural phenomena, for access to what they believed was a dimensional threshold, a gateway to something beyond normal reality, something they could study, potentially harness, potentially weaponize and use. Access was immediately forbidden. Local civilians were banned from approaching. Guards were posted on all roads. Anyone attempting to approach was turned away at gunpoint. Several locals who persisted were arrested. Some were never seen again. The official reason given was military exercises, weapons testing. But villagers reported activity that didn't match any weapons testing. Excavations inside the chapel. Not subtle investigations. Major digging. Equipment brought in under tarps. The sound of jackhammers echoing from inside the structure. Equipment transported at night. Trucks arriving after midnight. Loads covered with canvas. Shapes underneath that suggested complex machinery. One witness reported seeing electrical equipment, generators, devices with coils and meters that seemed far too sophisticated for 1939 technology. Trucks arriving with crates marked with unfamiliar symbols. Not German words. Symbols that looked old. Geometric patterns. Signs that made your eyes hurt if you stared at them too long. Lights burning until dawn. Every window in the castle lit. Generators running constantly. And sometimes other sounds. Sounds that carried through the forest. Like metal scraping. Like something breathing. Like voices speaking words that weren't words. The Nazis were obsessed with power sites. They sent expeditions to Tibet, to Antarctica, to locations all over Europe where legend spoke of unusual phenomena. Anything that might grant advantage or access to forces beyond human. Hauska Castle was high on their list. Documents discovered after the war showed they'd been researching it since 1933. They planned the seizure years in advance. No official records explain exactly what they did there. The documents were either destroyed in the final days of the war or captured and buried in archives that have never been opened. But we know some things, from scattered reports, from witness testimony, from what happened to the officers involved after the war. Several officers connected to the Huska operation died under strange circumstances between 1946 and 1952. Suicides described as unusual. One officer shot himself in the head, but the angle of the wound suggested someone else pulled the trigger. Accidents that didn't quite make sense. One officer died in a car crash on a straight road in perfect weather. Sudden illnesses doctors couldn't diagnose. Wasting diseases. Neurological degradation. One officer was found in his Berlin apartment in 1950, sitting calmly in a chair. Every mirror in his home was shattered, methodically, completely. Not just cracked, pulverized, glass powder on the floor. He'd bled out from cuts on both hands, deep lacerations across palms, fingers, wrists, self-inflicted. The glass from the mirrors was embedded in his flesh. His final words, according to the police report. It followed me back. I thought the distance would matter. I thought I could leave it there. But distance means nothing to it. It's been here the whole time, waiting, watching. It knew I'd come back. The castle was abandoned again, locked, sealed, left to the forest, left to whatever remained below. Paranormal investigators who visit Hauska today, in the 21st century, armed with scientific equipment and skeptical minds, report consistent patterns they cannot explain through natural causes. Electronics fail near the chapel in ways that don't match normal electromagnetic interference or equipment malfunction. Fully charged batteries drain in minutes, not gradually as you'd expect from cold or age, instantly. Full charge to dead in seconds, multiple batteries, different brands, all at once, as if something is drawing power directly from them. Cameras malfunction in specific ways. Digital cameras show static where there should be clear images. Photographs that display perfectly in the viewfinder appear corrupted when downloaded. Strange artifacts appear. Shadows where there shouldn't be shadows. dark spots that move between frames. Recording equipment stops without explanation. Devices that were working perfectly outside the chapel stop functioning the moment you cross the threshold. They'll restart outside. Stop again inside, as if something doesn't want to be recorded, doesn't want evidence. Visitors experience sudden pressure in their heads. Not a headache, pressure, like atmospheric pressure, changing rapidly. Ears pop, vision blurs. Some report nosebleeds that start suddenly and stop just as suddenly when they leave. Nausea without cause. People with strong stomachs suddenly feel violently ill. The sensation of vertigo. The room seems to tilt. Disorientation in familiar spaces. Investigators who've been to the chapel multiple times report getting lost, not finding their way through rooms they've mapped. Corridors that feel longer than they should be. The sensation of being physically pushed by invisible hands. Not imagined. Physical. Force applied to your body. Hard enough to make you stumble. Hard enough to leave bruises. Animals won't enter certain rooms. Not just reluctance. Absolute refusal. Guide dogs, trained to go anywhere their handlers need them, sit and refuse to cross specific thresholds. No amount of encouragement works. Birds won't fly over the central courtyard. They veer around it. Change direction mid-flight to avoid passing over that space. Even insects avoid particular areas. No spider webs in corners that should be perfect for webs. No ants, no flies. The bugs know something. Some visitors report intrusive thoughts. Not their thoughts. Not from their own minds. Not anything they would ever think on their own. Not images or hallucinations. Not seeing things that aren't there. Something more insidious than that. Thoughts. Ideas. Concepts. Complete sentences that appear fully formed in your consciousness without any process of thinking for them. Without any build-up. Without any connection to what you were just thinking about. Just suddenly there, in your mind, as if someone reached inside your skull and placed them there. Thoughts that don't feel like their own. The syntax is wrong. The vocabulary is strange. You think things you would never think, using words you don't normally use, from perspectives that aren't yours. Foreign thoughts in your own voice. The sudden urge to go down, to find the pit beneath the chapel, to open it, to remove the stones, to descend into the dark. The thought arrives completely developed, completely formed. You need to go down there. You need to see what's below. You need to know. You need to free it. And for just a moment, it makes perfect sense. For just a heartbeat, it seems like the most logical thing in the world. As if something is reaching through consciousness itself. Testing. Probing. Looking for minds that are receptive. Looking for someone weak enough, curious enough, foolish enough to obey. Testing. Always testing. Never forcing. But suggestion. Gentle suggestion. Patient suggestion. Photographs sometimes capture shadow figures where none existed. Professional photographers with professional equipment review their images later and find things they didn't see when taking the shot. Not motion blur, not artifacts. Distinct shapes. Solid. Three-dimensional. Humanoid. Two legs. Two arms. Vertical posture. Standing. But details are wrong. Proportions slightly off. Limbs too long. Head too large. Standing in doorways. In corners, behind people in group shots, observing, multiple photographs, taken by different people, with different cameras, across decades, show the same figure. Tall, 7 feet minimum. Featureless. No face. No clothing details. Just dark shape. Solid black that doesn't reflect light properly. Motionless. Never blurred. Never caught mid-motion. Always still. Always watching, always in the same location. Southwest corner of the chapel. Exact position, identifiable across multiple photographs. Always facing the camera, not the photographer. The camera. The lens. As if it knows it's being recorded. As if it wants to be documented. The word demonic gets dismissed as primitive superstition. Medieval fear. Religious hysteria. But strip away the religious framework, strip away the theology. What are we actually describing? Non-human intelligence. Something that thinks but doesn't think like we do. That has intention, purpose, but not human goals, hostile to human presence, or at minimum, incompatible with human consciousness. Contact causes psychological damage. Proximity causes physiological effects. Existing outside normal perception, not visible in normal light, not audible in normal frequencies, not detectable by normal senses unless it chooses to be, capable of affecting consciousness directly, inserting thoughts, influencing decision-making without the subject being aware they're being influenced, capable of affecting physical space. Electronics fail. Objects move. Sounds occur without obvious sources. Modern theories about interdimensional entities, about non-corporeal intelligence, about consciousness existing in higher dimensions that intersect with our reality, describe exactly this. The terminology has changed. The framework has changed. But the observed phenomena haven't. Medieval people called them demons, because that was the vocabulary available to them. Today, we might say, extra-dimensional beings, psychic phenomena, quantum anomalies, different language, different explanatory models, same behavior, same patterns, primal fear responses that bypass conscious thought, psychological degradation from exposure, not fear-induced mental illness, direct damage to consciousness from contact with something consciousness wasn't designed to process. Physical effects without physical contact, batteries draining, equipment failing, bodies reacting, but no physical mechanism, just proximity to something that operates by different rules, persistence across centuries. Whatever is at Hauska has been there since before the castle was built. 700 years of architecture weighing down on it, and still present, still active, still patient. Whatever exists beneath Hauska doesn't behave like a ghost. Ghosts are echoes, residual energy, memories trapped in stone. This is active, aware, intentional, contained but not dormant, sealed but not sleeping, still there, still awake, still watching, still patient. Was the pit ever truly sealed, or just slowed? The castle stands. 700 years of stone and timber and faith. The chapel remains intact. 7 centuries of consecration cover the opening. But containment isn't elimination. Sealing isn't destroying. And history shows a disturbing pattern. Whenever humans find places like this, whenever we discover something our ancestors sealed away, we eventually return. We can't help ourselves. We're compulsive investigators, driven by curiosity, the human need to understand, to explain, to fit everything into our frameworks, driven by ambition, by the belief that knowledge is power, that understanding something gives us control over it, driven by arrogance, by the belief that we're beyond our ancestors' fears, that their warnings were born of ignorance, that we, with our science and technology, are beyond superstition. The Nazis believed that. They believed medieval fear was just fear, that there was nothing at Hauska that German science couldn't understand, control, harness. They returned to Hauska convinced they could master what others had only been able to contain. They failed. Whatever they tried, it didn't work, or it worked in ways they didn't expect. in ways they couldn't control, but they won't be the last. Someone else will come. Someone always does. Because whatever is below has been patient for far longer than 700 years, far longer than human civilization, far longer than our species has existed. It doesn't need to escape. It doesn't need to break containment. That would be crude. That would alert everyone to the danger. It just needs to wait. Wait for the walls to crumble naturally. Wait for faith to wane. Wait for someone curious enough, ambitious enough, foolish enough to weaken the seals. It just needs to wait for the next person who believes they're strong enough to look into the pit without flinching. Smart enough to understand what they're seeing without going mad. Brave enough to touch what should not be touched. To open the door. To remove the stones. To descend. And throughout history, there's always someone. Always someone who believes they'll be the exception. Who believes the warnings don't apply to them. That person is coming. Maybe not today. Maybe not this year. But they're coming. They always do. And when they arrive, the thing below will be waiting, patient, ready, as it always has been. Some doors were built to stay closed, not by accident, not through superstition, not from irrational fear, not because what's behind them is imaginary, but because what's behind them is real, real and dangerous, real and patient. Real and completely incompatible with human existence. Hauska Castle doesn't scream warnings. It doesn't threaten. It doesn't demand anything. It simply exists. A monument. A marker. 700 years of physical presence saying, something important happened here. Something you should respect. Built over something humanity recognized as dangerous enough to bury beneath stone. Prayer and silence. Something our ancestors, who weren't stupid, who faced wars and plagues and all manner of human horror, something they thought was worth this level of effort to contain. If medieval people were wrong about what was down there, if they sealed the pit based on superstition and ignorance, then the castle makes no sense. The architecture is backwards. The chapel is misplaced. The paintings are fantasy. The entire structure is an elaborate exercise in pointlessness. But if they were right, if they sealed the pit because they knew, because they understood, because they'd seen what was down there and recognized the threat, then Hauska Castle isn't a relic of superstition. It's a warning written in stone. The most expensive, permanent, unmistakable warning medieval civilization could devise. A warning that has stood for 7 centuries. Through wars, through plagues, through modernization, still standing, still intact, still performing its function. A warning that asks one question, a question every generation must answer anew, a question we keep forgetting to ask. If something was terrible enough, that an entire kingdom committed massive resources to building a fortress over it. What happens when we forget why it was built? What happens when the warning fades from active memory to legend? From legend to rumor? From rumor to forgotten story? From forgotten story to nothing at all? What happens when we lose the context, but the structure remains? When we see the walls but don't understand their purpose. When we see the defenses but don't remember what they defend against. When we walk through the chapel and don't read the paintings as warnings. Warnings only work if we listen. If we respect them. If we believe our ancestors had good reasons. And we've never been good at listening. This has been Whispers from the Dark. Season 2. I'm Raven Vale. Some places are better left undisturbed, not because they're empty, but because they're full, full of things that have been contained for very good reasons. Some doors are better left closed, not because we're afraid of what we'll find, but because we should be. And some questions are better left unasked, not because we won't get answers, but because we will. And the answers will change us in ways we can't anticipate, in ways we can't reverse, because the answers to those questions are still down there, below the castle, below the chapel, below 700 years of stone and prayer. Still there, still aware, still waiting. Waiting for someone to ask, waiting for someone to listen, waiting for someone to open the door and invite them through. And they're very, very patient, waiting.